From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how Texas public school curriculum could be teaching Christianity.
I believe public schools are not Sunday schools, or as Governor Abbott is fond of saying, schools are for education, not indoctrination.
In Texas, it will be harder to vote this presidential election than it was 4 years ago, and how Arkansans are fighting to put abortion on their ballot. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1962, the Supreme Court case Ingle v. Vitale ruled that state officials cannot require or encourage students to recite an official school prayer in public schools. The court ruled that this practice violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which protects Americans' freedom to practice their religion. The court's decision was a landmark case that established the current prohibition on state-sponsored prayer in U.S. schools. Here in Texas, this week at the House Public Education Committee hearing, State Representative James Tallarico, an Austin area Democrat, politely chastised Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath over violating the Establishment Clause with a new lesson plan for the state's public schools that he said requires Texas teachers to preach Christianity to their students.
Is it likely that a teacher, when asked about a religious question, now that we're teaching it in our curriculum, is it likely that the teacher will respond with their own religious beliefs simply because that's what they know? So would an atheist teacher tell their students that Jesus wasn't resurrected and that it's just a story? Or will a Catholic teacher respond based on their church teachings? Will a Presbyterian teacher respond based on their denomination's teachings?
I don't know whether that's likely.
Okay. Why does this new state curriculum refer to the Torah or the Tanakh or the Hebrew Scriptures multiple times as the Old Testament? Jews don't call it the Old Testament.
I'm relatively certain the materials refer to it as the Torah and the Tanakh, and that it also is referred to by Christians as the Old Testament.
It is referred to by Christians, only Christians, as the Old Testament. So at one point in fifth grade's Unit 10, it tells teachers to explain how the Old Testament of the Bible, again, that's a Christian term, Jewish folks would not respond, would not call it the Old Testament, explain how the Old Testament of the Bible had many prophecies about a future Savior that are written as fulfilled in the New Testament by Jesus. I was shocked when I read that in the fifth grade curriculum, the idea that the Hebrew Scriptures are predicting Jesus is some Christians believe that, but it's certainly not a view shared by Jews. So can you shed some light on why this is being posited as fact rather than explained as a belief of some Christians?
What I can shed a great deal of light on is the development process that the materials go through.
Morath told committee members that the state-approved lessons are focused on teaching children to read, and the references to Christianity were included to provide additional vocabulary and context for students and not intended as religious instruction.
Is it true that on page 238 of the new Texas third grade curriculum, teachers are encouraged to play the Christian song Away in the Manger in their classrooms?
I mean, I'll have to take your word for it. I don't have it in front of me.
Does the new Texas curriculum encourage teachers to play songs from other religious traditions in their classrooms?
I don't know.
Okay. Is it true that on page 248 of the new Texas third grade curriculum, students learn that, quote, the Bible explains that Jesus rose from the dead 3 days after his death by the Roman authorities, followers of Jesus visited his tomb and found it empty. An angel appeared and said, he has risen, and led them into the tomb. When the visitors entered the tomb, they found it empty.
I presume you are reading from the instructional material, so I have to believe that that's in there, yes.
Okay.
Sir.
How do you believe teachers will respond to elementary school students when they ask how a human being can rise from the dead?
What we attempt to do is provide training and support to teachers so that as kids ask questions on any subjects that emerge in the lesson, that they can be equipped to handle those conversations.
As I said earlier, I believe public schools are not Sunday schools, or as Governor Abbott is fond of saying, schools are for education, not indoctrination.
The focus of the exchange centered around HB 1605, which was passed last year by the Republican-controlled Texas legislature. The law was designed to provide teachers with state-approved lesson plans and make those materials available to parents via an online portal. But the new law also provides public school teachers with immunity from prosecution for violating the separation of church and state. I spoke with State Representative James Tallarico about the hearing and his concerns.
This is all part of a national movement to indoctrinate students with a particular brand of Christianity. Christian nationalism is on the rise in Texas and across the nation. And, you know, I'm doing my best to push back against that because I am a proud Christian, but I also believe deeply in our United States Constitution. And in our First Amendment, there is the freedom of religion and the freedom from religion. And I worry that this new curriculum, by elevating Christianity over all the other major world religions, is violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which prohibits the government from establishing a state religion. That's exactly what this curriculum does. I'm not opposed to students learning about the major world religions. In fact, I think they should, including Christianity. What I have a problem with is elevating Christianity above all the other traditions and indoctrinating students into a particular religious ideology.
We heard from people who support this idea of teaching Christianity and the Bible in public classrooms, that this is a benign thing. This is actually good for students because it will help them understand our law and our system of government. Can you respond to that?
Well, so let's set the record straight. The state of Texas bought a national reading curriculum for elementary school from a well-respected publisher and then made substantial revisions to that curriculum. And so we can see the before and after. In the original curriculum, Christianity appears alongside Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism as the major world religions. But in this new revised curriculum, the state of Texas has removed all of those lessons on the other major faiths and instead has added sections that teach the Bible as historical fact, as undisputed truth. And that's a problem in public schools. It's not a problem in Sunday schools. It's not a problem in church. It is a problem in our neighborhood public schools. And so this is not benign. This is actually an insidious attempt to indoctrinate very young children into a certain religious and political ideology. It's inappropriate, to say the least, and I believe it's also unconstitutional.
Do they want the Bible seen as a literal history, including the creation of the universe and Noah and the flood?
Based on my reading of this revised curriculum, that is the case. You know, when you read the curriculum, and I encourage your listeners to read it for themselves so that they can make their own decision, but the biblical material is presented in a devotional way, in a religious way that, you know, is reminiscent of what you would hear in church or in Sunday schools. It is not presented in an academic way. There are no qualifiers that this is what Christians believe or this is what some Christians believe. Instead, it is stated as simple fact that Jesus rose from the dead after 3 days in the tomb, or attributing certain teachings like the Golden Rule only to Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I love Jesus with all of my heart and soul as a Christian, but I know that Jesus didn't come up with the golden rule. Moses and Buddha taught the golden rule thousands of years before Jesus was born. I happen to think that's a beautiful thing, that the golden rule appears in all of these major world religions from every corner of the globe. I think that's a beautiful thing to teach our students so that they can learn to accept and appreciate other cultures outside of their own. But in this new revised curriculum, the state of Texas is essentially erasing thousands of years of religious history and attributing the golden rule only to Jesus. This is inappropriate. And I personally think that if Jesus were to read this curriculum, he would remind us to treat Jewish students as we want to be treated, treat Muslim students the way we want to be treated, treat Hindu and Buddhist and atheist students the way we want to be treated. So not only is this unconstitutional, I also think it's deeply unchristian.
So how do you think if these Bible stories are taught in school as fact, how would that sit or be received by non-Christian faith students? Would this make them be like outsiders in the classrooms?
Well, it's you know, I used to be a Texas public school teacher. I taught middle school, sixth grade. And so I know that it's really hard to be different as a kid. It's hard enough to be a Jewish kid in Texas public schools. It's hard enough to be a Hindu or a Muslim kid in Texas public schools. And now their teachers are being forced to preach the Bible at the front of the classroom and elevating their, you know, one particular brand of Christianity over their faith tradition. And so I imagine this is going to make their lives harder. And that's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing.
Do you see this as a major move to break down the firewall between church and state?
I do. I think it's part of a larger attempt to dismantle public education, to attack our Constitution and attack our freedoms. The same Christian nationalists that are using Christianity to control women or bash gay people are now using it to indoctrinate young children. And so this is an attack on our democracy, on our communities, and on our families. And I hope everyone across the state of Texas, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of your religious background, can come together and take a stand for our Constitution and for our democracy.
Well, we have an election day coming up pretty soon. Is this going to be reflected at the polls?
I hope so. I was just on a national Zoom call of fellow Christians speaking up for Vice President Harris. I was on a national call last night of evangelicals in particular, voicing their support for Vice President Harris, even when they don't agree with her on every single issue. And I think that's because you've seen these Christian nationalists abuse and pervert Christianity for their own political gain. And so I hope people of faith and Christians in particular are waking up to the fact that Donald Trump and the extreme right don't reflect Christian values and certainly don't reflect the teachings of Jesus.
State Representative James Tallarico is a Democrat and represents Texas House District 52, which includes north of Austin, Round Rock, and Hutto. It will be harder for Texans to vote in this presidential election than it was just 4 years ago. That's a finding from the Brenham Center for Justice in their new report, How Voting Laws Have Changed in Battleground States Since 2020. Looking at these battleground states overall, you can see that it's a mixed bag. Some key swing states, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, they've enacted new restrictive laws that mainly target mail-in voting. Other states, Michigan and Nevada, Wisconsin, they've passed laws that expand opportunities for voters. And in Pennsylvania, nothing has changed. But here in Texas, well, even though the state voted for Donald Trump in 2020 and there was no evidence of voter fraud, Texas passed SB 1, which makes it harder to vote. It reduces polling places, increases barriers for voters with disabilities, and makes it easier for voters to be scrubbed from the voter rolls. Currently, 2.1 million Texans have been suspended from voting in the November 8th election. That's 12% of the voting population. I spoke with Sarah Carter, an attorney with the Brennan Center, to find out more.
Overall, we are seeing a stark divide between states that are trying to make it harder to vote and then states that are working to make it easier for their residents to cast a ballot. And it's important to note when we look at the laws that these states are passing that expansive and restrictive voting laws don't just cancel each other out. State lawmakers have passed laws that make voting harder in places where it's already hard to vote. And then we look at other parts of the country where voting is more accessible already, and we see some state legislatures working to make it easier for eligible Americans to cast a ballot. I think attempts to overturn the 2020 election failed, as we know, but the same sort of conspiracy theories that animated that spirit of election denialism that we saw in 2020 have fueled the wave of restrictive voting legislation that we've seen over the past few years. And we've seen an intense sort of focus on voting in general in battleground states that were, many of which were in the spotlight in 2020 and were a sort of focal point of the election denialism movement. So we see some state lawmakers weaponizing election misinformation, like baseless claims of widespread voter fraud, to justify their efforts to make it harder for people to vote. And SB1 in Texas is a good example of that, as supporters of that law echoed the same sorts of lies that were espoused by election denialists about widespread fraud in mail voting, for example. And now, with the high volume that we're seeing of restrictive bills passed around the country, we're seeing a sort of continuation in 2024 of the damage from the 2020 election denialism movement. But we also see some swing states, as I noted, making it easier for their residents to vote. Michigan and Nevada are good examples of that.
So in Texas, we saw the Donald Trump big lie manifest itself as the voters have lost confidence in the voting system, and so therefore we need to pass SB1, which was this massive bill that took in all sorts of ideas that tweaked our voting system in Texas. What did we end up with SB1?
So SB1 is really replete with restrictive voting provisions and election interference provisions. And as I noted, SB1, yes, a lot of the supporters of SB1 were espousing the same sorts of election conspiracy theories about 2020 that we're still seeing today. And SB1 took aim at a number of aspects of voting, many of which had been previously expanded during the COVID-19 crisis to respond to the sort of constraints that the pandemic put on voters' ability to cast a ballot in person. So I guess what I'm saying here is that SB1 targeted mail voting specifically.
Sarah Carter is an attorney with the Brennan Center. She is a co-author of the report, How Voting Laws Have Changed in Battleground States Since 2020. The abortion issue looms large over this presidential election. Democrats are promising to reverse the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and many Republicans are in favor of a nationwide abortion ban. In March, the Republican Study Committee in Congress released a budget that endorses a national abortion ban with zero exceptions for rape or incest. So many voters will be going to the polls in just a few weeks to express their voice on abortion access. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, there are now 8 states with pro-abortion rights ballot initiatives in this election cycle. And this week, the secretaries of state in Arizona and Missouri greenlit their abortion referendums. The 6 other states include Florida, New York, Maryland, Colorado, Nevada, and South Dakota. So here we need to note that in Texas, we will not have an opportunity to vote on an abortion referendum or any other referendums because Texas does not allow for direct ballot initiatives in the state. But our neighboring state of Arkansas does, and a citizen effort to put an abortion referendum on the ballot has been stymied. Tess Verbin is a reporter covering the issue for the Arkansas Advocate, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization.
It's really in the hands of the courts now. It hasn't been, the folks that are supporting the amendment are not giving up. The measure itself would legalize abortion up to 18 weeks of pregnancy, and it would also allow abortion in cases of rape and incest and a fatal fetal anomaly or to protect the life or the health of the pregnant individual. That is, the 18-week limit is more restrictive than the restrictions that were in place before Roe v. Wade was overturned, but Roe v. Wade being overturned put the trigger law into place, which banned abortion outright except for a narrow exception to save the mother's life. And the effort to get it on the ballot was actually, the effort to get anything on the ballot became more difficult this year because last year the legislature passed a law that increased the number of counties you need to collect signatures from to get an amendment or a proposed change to statute on the ballot, raised it from 15 counties to 50 counties. Which is a pretty big jump, and that's being challenged in court as well. But for context, there are 75 counties in Arkansas. And the ballot language, the amendment itself, has to get approved by the state attorney general before people can start collecting signatures. And it took three tries for the ballot question committee to get language approved. They got it approved by the Republican Attorney General, Tim Griffin, in January. They had been trying to get that approved since November, and they had tweaked it a couple of times. And then, so they spent about almost 6 months collecting signatures. And the deadline to collect signatures to turn them into the Secretary of State was July 5th. The effort still needed about 10,000 signatures. The ballot question committee said, like, at the beginning of that week, and you need a little over 90,000 valid signatures from registered voters in those 50 counties to qualify for the ballot. They were about 10,000 behind at the beginning of that week, but then by the end of it, by the time they turned it in, they were about 12,000 past the minimum, and they were pretty overjoyed about it. There was basically a rally in the Capitol when the movers were bringing in these boxes after boxes of petitions, and people had signs, people were chanting and cheering. There was a lot of excitement among the supporters. There were a handful of opponents, protesters with their own signs, but much fewer than the supporters. And this was July 5th, and so July 10th, the Secretary of State, John Thurston, said that the supporters hadn't turned in the correct paperwork regarding the paid canvassers, people collecting signatures. Most of the signature collectors were unpaid volunteers, but a handful of them were paid, and there are certain legal criteria for making sure that these folks are educated on state law pertaining to the collection of signatures before they go out and do that. And the supporters have to, like, testify to that, provide an affidavit, and also a list of the paid canvassers. They hired more and more paid canvassers over time, so the ballot question committee had turned in a series of updated lists to the Secretary of State. And on the day of the deadline, they say that Thurston's staff told them they had turned in everything right. So they felt very like they'd been baited and switched less than a week later when Thurston said, no, you didn't do this right. And they said, actually, we did turn in the right paperwork. They they asked Thurston to decide to count the signatures instead, and he still said no, so they've appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has ordered a series of briefs that have been filed. The Griffin and Thurston are really doubling down. They've said over and over again, you didn't turn the right things in the right order. The supporters of the amendment are saying they're accusing Thurston of viewpoint discrimination, saying he's personally anti-abortion. He's been endorsed by Arkansas Right to Life. They're one of the anti-abortion groups that has been very vocally opposed to the amendment. He donated to the group. You can see it in campaign finance records. And Griffin asked the court to dismiss the petition so that if that were to happen, then the amendment would not be on the ballot. But the court hasn't answered that motion yet. It continues to kind of be a heated argument between people and state officials. Supporters of other amendments that might be or will be on the ballot have said, hey, the argument you're using against this one could affect ours too.
Arkansans for Limited Government, the group that is supporting the proposed constitutional amendment, are they saying out loud that they feel that the Secretary of State, John Thurston's office, is deliberately bending the law against them, that he's moving the goalpost because he doesn't like this abortion question? He wants it off the ballot.
That is what they're saying. Yes, they have pointed to court cases where Thurston has made an argument that would support their case. They've said that the law itself, the one he keeps citing pertaining to these documents, is not as specific as he's saying that it is, and that because it's been clear that he is anti-abortion and in his political values, that he must, that is part of why he initially said that his office wasn't even going to count signatures.
You know, our political watchers in Arkansas, are they surprised that this group, Arkansans for Limited Government, have been successful as they were to get this petition put together and at least get this far?
There was some surprise among conservatives, for sure. There were local conservative organizations who were very anti-abortion had released a statement when the signatures were turned in saying, oh, this is a radical abortion until birth measure, and it was supported by forces from California and New York, which there's really not proof of that, and trying to paint it as not actually reflective of the values of Arkansans. And I spoke to a lady with the anti-abortion protesters at the Capitol that day, and she said that she was surprised and a little disheartened because she had believed that out-of-state forces were seeking signatures and promoting the amendment, and she said that she was getting the impression at that moment that actually Arkansans did support the amendment.
Tess Verbin is a reporter with the Arkansas Advocate, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can listen to past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org, and you can download us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.